I would like that our Divrei Torah today should be learned Lirufua Shlema Avraham Mordechai Ben Alta Chaya, who is a dear friend of mine who is having a very serious surgery that started this morning and is going straight through the entire day till this evening. It is our hope that he has a Rufua Shlema and that he should have only Besuras Tovas from whatever it is that has to be taken care of. So we're in the middle of our series on Hilchos Shabbos. And as we mentioned, if you look through the pages of Chumash, you will not find 39 categories of melacha. You will not find anything that outlines exactly what one is allowed to do on Shabbos or what perhaps one is not allowed to do on Shabbos. And this is why the Gemara in Maseches Chagiga refers to the melachos as kahararim hatluyim bisari. These are like big mountains that are hanging on just a small thread because there is very little inside of the Torah text itself that informs us about how exactly we are supposed to keep Shabbos. There are only four melachos out of the 39 that are mentioned explicitly in Chumash. And as we said in previous weeks, those are Choresh, you're not allowed to plow. Kotzer means you're not allowed to harvest. Havara means you're not allowed to ignite a flame. And Hotzah is you're not allowed to carry outside. And the Rishonim are bothered. Why does the Torah go out of its way to mention these four when the Torah does not mention any of the other melachos of Shabbos? Everything else had to be figured out by the Chachamim. But those four were mentioned explicitly in the Chumash itself. So the Rishonim explained why those were mentioned, but we assume that the 39 melachos are melachos that we need to be very aware of and very cognizant of because they are very complicated, and it is not easy to really define what exactly would be a prohibited act on Shabbos and what perhaps might be permissible. If it were up to me, I would have drawn a very different set of criterion for what should be allowed on Shabbos and what perhaps not. Let's say somebody lives in an apartment building. I know somebody who just moved into the 14th floor of an apartment building in the city. So he's making a kiddush on Shabbos, and he's having many, many guests. So you're going to tell me that for him to schlep up a big stack of chairs up 14 flights of steps on Shabbos, I would have said that should be a malacha. That shouldn't be permissible. And yet we know there's nothing wrong with that at all. However, if a person walks outside and just happens to be carrying a small hairpin or happens to be carrying something that is so insignificant, we say that that would be considered a malacha. So how exactly we define the malachos is very difficult to figure out. We know when it comes, let's say, to putting something together, you would be allowed to, let's say, extend the table and put a leaf into the table. That would not be a malacha at all. But yet, if a leg of the table falls off and all you need is just one small screw to put it back together, that would be considered a malacha. So one has to be very aware, one has to really be learned to understand how we define the malachos and what is considered to be prohibited on Shabbos and what perhaps might be permissible. How do we figure this out? So the Gemara tells us, we look back, we reference ourselves to the story of Hakamas HaMishkan. We learn how the Mishkan was constructed, how the Mishkan was built, and whatever activities were necessary for the Mishkan to have been built are the activities that for us are not permissible on Shabbos. So therefore, in the Mishkan, since they had to build, every time they constructed the Mishkan, they had to build it and put it together. Therefore, we have a malacha of bona on Shabbos. In the Mishkan, since they had to offer a menachos, since they had to offer sacrifices that were made of wheat, of grain, therefore we are not allowed to harvest. We are not allowed to plant because that was something that was necessary to be done in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan as well, they had to dye all of the yurios. How do you refer to those? All the curtains that were placed on top of the Mishkan. And therefore we assume that soveya is something that is not permissible on Shabbos. So all of the malachas as we know them are derived directly from the way that the Mishkan was constructed. And whatever was done in order for the Mishkan to be put together are the activities that are not permissible for us to do. And because we learn from the Mishkan, not only do we learn the 39 categories of malacha from the Mishkan, but we also learn how exactly to define the malacha itself as it relates to us as well. For example, we have a malacha, as we mentioned, of bona. You're not allowed to build on Shabbos. So what does it mean you're not allowed to build? You're not allowed to build something temporary, or you're not allowed to build something permanent. So that's a discussion that the Yerushalmi Maseches Shabbos has. What does it mean you're not allowed to build on Shabbos? Says the Yerushalmi, in order to define the malacha of bona on Shabbos, let's look back at what took place in the times of the Mishkan. Well, in those days, when they put up the Mishkan, it was not something that was put up with the intent that it would be there forever. The Mishkan was put up, and then when they traveled somewhere else, they had to take it down, and then they had to put it up again. And therefore, says the Yerushalmi, the same way in the times of the Mishkan, when bona was done, when that act was being performed, we assume that it was done and it was as a very temporary structure that was put together because it was put up and then taken down once again. Therefore, bona for our purposes is the very same as well. And we assume that even if you build something that you intend to take down, that doesn't make a difference. That also would be a violation of the malacha of bona b'Shabbos. Now, how temporary do we consider that? If somebody makes something made out of Lego, is that really considered to be bona, even though it's very temporary, but maybe we should say temporary is an issue as well. So this is obviously a detail that you have to look into, and it's something we don't have enough time to go into in one shiur today. But in general, we assume the malachos, as they took place in the Mishkan, are the way that we define the violation of a malacha today as well. Let's say the Gemara says we have a malacha called Hotzah. One is not allowed to carry outside on Shabbos without an Erev. Now, most of our communities have a reliable Erev, so we don't generally worry about it. And that's part of the problem. We've become so accustomed, we've become so used to living with an Erev, that when we go to a community that does not have an Erev, we don't even know what to do with ourselves. And very often we find ourselves making a mistake and carrying things that should not have been carried and doing things that we shouldn't do because we are so used to the fact that we live in a society where we have an Erev. So that's something one always has to be aware of, but the Gemara discusses, what about carrying a human being outside? So generally, in the times of the Mishkan, the Gemara says, they used to carry not people, they didn't carry a Kohen who had to do his job in the Beis HaMikdash, nobody picked him up and put him into the Mishkan. Generally, what was carried in the times of the Mishkan was the beams, or the tables, or the different utensils, the items that were necessary to have a functioning Mishkan. And therefore, the Gemara has an opinion that perhaps we should say, when it comes to carrying a human being, maybe if you carry a human being outside, we would not assume that that is a malacha of Hotzah b'Shabbos, because after all, that is not the way the malacha of Hotzah was performed in the Mishkan. The point of all this is that our malachas are derived from the Mishkan, not only the categories of malacha, but also the defining characteristics of what that malacha is are also determined primarily from the Mishkan as well. As we mentioned a few weeks ago, I'm just doing a quick recap. I know we had a week off, so people may have forgotten. So, as we mentioned a few weeks ago as well, if a person does a malacha bishinui, if a person does a malacha in an unusual fashion, that also would make the malacha no longer prohibited. And therefore, we assume, the same way in the Mishkan, when they had to carry a beam from point A to point B, nobody carried the beam under their arm. Everybody carried the beam in the normal way that a beam was carried. When a person has to carry a needle, let's say you have to pin up your dress, but you don't have a needle, so you have to get it from somewhere else. When you carry a needle, the normal way to carry it is you hold it in your hand and you bring it from point A to point B. So if you put a needle somewhere else, that would not be the normal way of carrying it. That is what we refer to as kila achar yad. You do it in an unusual fashion, or a shinu. You do something not the normal way that you would otherwise have done it. And in any case like that, for example, the Gemara says, normally I write with my right hand, but if I write with my left hand, that's a very unusual way to write. Many, many examples like that that the Gemara talks about, if I normally cut my fingers with a nail clipper, but I choose to bite them off, all of these examples would be considered to be doing a malacha bishinu. You are doing something in a very unusual fashion, not the normal way you would do it at all. Now, some people always bite their nails. I never would. So for me, that would be a shinui. So generally, we assume when a malacha is performed bishinui in an unusual way from the normal way that you otherwise would have done it, it is no longer considered to be a malacha once again, because in the times of the Mishkan, nobody would have thought to do a malacha like that. Nobody would carry under their arm. Nobody would carry something in between their legs. Nobody would cut something with their mouth instead of with their scissors or with an instrument. Nobody would write with the wrong hand instead of writing with the regular hand that they normally use. And therefore we assume all of those are not considered to be a malacha. Well, if that's the case, one can go through an entire experience of Shabbos doing every malacha under the sun. I could drive my car with my feet, and I can write with my left hand, and I can do everything under the sun, just do it in an unusual fashion, and what would Shabbos be? So the Chachamim were concerned about that, and they said, how can we have such a situation where a person can go through an entire experience of Shabbos and never actually feel the fact that it's Shabbos? You can be doing everything you do normally during the week, just do it in a little bit of an unusual fashion, and then everything's okay. So the Chachamim said, well, we cannot allow this. We cannot have that happen. And therefore they said, midrabanan, on a rabbinic level, they said, you're not allowed to be involved, you're not allowed to engage in such activity, even if you do it in an unusual fashion. But strictly speaking, we assume, primarily that is not a malacha because it is not the way it was normally done in the Mishkan. Any questions so far? Does that mean nobody knows what I'm talking about, or that means everybody is very clear about what we're saying? I hope it means everyone's clear, but you can feel free to ask questions at any point, as is always the case. So we mentioned as well that in the times of the building of the Mishkan, we learned that everything had to be done b'meleches machsheves. Everything had to be done with a mindfulness. Everything had to be done with specific intent to create the Mishkan that was being built. And because the creation of the Mishkan required that we had everything done b'meleches machsheves with specific intent to do the activity that is being done. Therefore, the melechos of Shabbos also will only be violated if a person has specific intent for the outcome, for the result that is being done, that is happening, that is occurring as an outcome of that which I am doing. And therefore, the Gemara discusses the following case. The Gemara Maseches Shabbos Daf Chaf Beis says we have a melacha referred to as choresh. You're not allowed to plow. Now, most of us don't have farms. Most of us would never plow regardless. So would you say that the melacha of choresh doesn't apply to us? Of course it applies to us. Just we have to figure out what is considered to be charisha, what is considered to be plowing in our terms. For those of us who don't live on a farm, what does plowing mean? So the Gemara says plowing means anything that you do to the ground which changes its status. So you have somebody comes around and takes a shovel and digs out some dirt, that is called choresh, that is plowing. If you have somebody who comes and digs a furrow into the ground, even if you don't uproot the grass, but you move the dirt to the side, and you are machsherit lizria, now it is more susceptible to being used for planting, so we assume that is considered to be the malacha of choresh. Now once again, most of us would never go on a Shabbos and take a shovel and dig out in the ground. We know that's not allowed. So how is it practically relevant to us? Well, it's very relevant. The Gemara talks about the case. If I'm in my backyard on a beautiful Shabbos afternoon in the summer, it's beautiful weather, and the sun has now moved from this side of the backyard to the other side. But my lawn chair has not moved yet from one side to the other, and I'm not strong enough to actually pick it up and move it from one side of the backyard to the other. Am I allowed to take the chair and drag it on the floor to the other side of the backyard because now I want to sit in the sun? Would that be permissible on Shabbos? Well, what should be the potential problem? Says the Gemara, the potential problem is that maybe while you drag it, there's going to be some sort of charisha. There's going to be some sort of plowing because the legs of the chair are going to dig a furrow into the ground, and maybe that should pose a problem of being choresh b'Shabbos. So this is discussed in the Gemara, and the Gemara comes to the conclusion, the opinion of Reb Shimon is that since you have no interest in that which is happening, since you don't at all want the fact that the ground should be dug out as you drag the floor, and quite frankly, you're probably upset about the fact that it's ripping up the grass, you're not happy about that. So we assume that a case like that, there would be no issue at all because it's an unintended consequence. I don't want that result at all. And therefore the Gemara says, since that's not at all the activity that you want to be involved in, all you really want is to get the chair from point A to point B. It just so happens to be that by doing that, maybe some of the grass will be ripped up or maybe some of the ground will be dug into. Therefore the Gemara assumes, since that's not at all what the person wants, that would not be a malacha on Shabbos at all. So therefore, we spoke about a woman wears high heels, and every so often when you have the high heels, it makes a hole into the ground. If you're walking on ground that's soft, or you have high heels that are very pointy, whatever it might be, we assume sometimes it might cause a hole in the ground, which should be a malacha of choresh as well, yet the Gemara assumes that would not be a problem. Why? Because that's not at all what you want to happen. And on the contrary, it's annoying when it happens. You get stuck in the ground and you can't walk, and you have to wipe off the dirt from the bottom of the heel. So we assume that would not be a problem at all to wear such a shoe on Shabbos, even though once in a while it might happen that you would violate the malacha of choresh. Even though once in a while your shoe will get stuck into the ground and you will cause a hole, and that should be a very clear violation of charisha, since that's not at all what you want, we assume it would be permissible. However, the only time it is permissible is when it's not definite that that's going to be the result. Let's say you have the kind of shoe, let's say you have sneakers that are cleats. So cleats are made that every time you walk on a certain kind of ground, it's going to get stuck in the ground, it's going to make a hole in the ground. So if you have something of that nature where every time you do it, it's certainly going to cause the malacha to occur, we assume that that is forbidden on Shabbos, even though I didn't want that result. So the Rambam gives the case. The Rambam says in his days, and in the times of the Gemara, they did not have any games for children to play on Shabbos. So what did children do on a long Shabbos afternoon? So we mentioned this a few weeks ago. The Gemara says the children used to play with the head of a chicken. That was the ball that they used. That was the game they used to play. They would throw it around, and that was what we would call a ball. That was what they used. So the problem is, comes a long Shabbos afternoon, the kids realize we forgot to prepare this before Shabbos. Nobody realized that we don't have any heads of chickens around to throw to each other to play around with. So what do? One kid says, why don't we go just cut off the head of a chicken now on Shabbos? Well, that's not permissible. How can you do that? In the Tilas and Shama, you're not allowed to kill an animal on Shabbos. So the kid says, what do you mean? I don't want to kill the animal. I just want the head. Well, it just so happens to be that the only way to get a head off of the body of an animal is if you kill it. But the kid says, I have no interest. So the Rambam says, well, that's automatic. Every time that you cut the head off of a chicken, the animal's going to die, and therefore we assume that would not be permissible, even though we know that it's not at all the result that the child wants. The child couldn't care less whether or not the chicken remains alive after the activity that he does. But since it's obvious and it's apparent that that's what's going to result every single time that this activity is done, therefore we assume that would not be permissible. Take a more common example. I assume most of us are not playing with chickens. Most of us don't wear those heels that are absolutely going to get stuck in the ground every time we walk. What about if you have a case like the refrigerator? So you forget to turn off the light in the refrigerator on Erev Shabbos, and now you have a problem. You cannot open the door on Shabbos because, after all, what's going to happen? The light's going to go on. That would be a malach of havara. You're turning on a light, you're igniting a flame. That is something that is not permissible on Shabbos. So what do you do? Well, on the one hand, it's a davar she'eino mischaven. Do I really want the light on in the refrigerator? Doesn't make a difference to me. I can see without the light in the refrigerator. I don't really want it on. All I want is to be able to open the door and get out the items from the fridge. However, since we know with certainty that every time you're going to open that door, the refrigerator light is going to go on, that is something that's referred to as a psik reshe. One is not allowed to open the refrigerator if you know that the light is going to go on. Even though it's not at all what you want, even though you really don't care whether or not the light goes on, but since it's inevitable that that's going to result as the outcome of the activity that I'm doing, therefore it is not permissible. Now, does that mean you have to starve the whole Shabbos? No, it means if you have a non-Jew in the house, you can ask the non-Jew to do it. There are ways around the problem, but for me, myself, to do it, that would not be permissible at all, because that's what we refer to as a psik reshe. That is something that would cause a major issue, because we know that every time you do this act, that result that is not permissible is going to be the outcome. Now let's talk about what we said we would speak about a few weeks ago, and that is the issue of baby wipes on Shabbos. Baby wipes on Shabbos is a fascinating issue, because baby wipes on Shabbos really revolves around this question of davar she'eino mischaven and a psik reshe. I have no interest. So let's just frame the conversation as follows. What could be a potential problem with using baby wipes on Shabbos? This is something that has been discussed over the last 50 years. I find it fascinating that all the Svarim and Hilchos Shabbos are arguing about the nature of how baby wipes are manufactured. It's a fascinating issue, as you'll see. So what is the potential issue? Well, the issue is schita. What is schita? One of the 39 melachos on Shabbos is you're not allowed to squeeze something. Where did they squeeze in the Mishkan? Where was it necessary to squeeze anything? Well, a very simple answer is every day they had to light the menorah. And in order to have a menorah, you need to have olive oil. In order to have olive oil, you need to squeeze out the olives. And in order to have wine in the Mishkan, in order to have that being sprinkled on the Mizbeach, you need to have grapes being squeezed out. So there were many activities that revolved around squeezing in the Mishkan. And therefore we assume, since that's what was necessary to have a functioning Mishkan, therefore that is an activity that is not permissible today. So, if I take a grape and I squeeze it out on Shabbos, that would certainly be the violation of Shechita b'Shabbos. There's no question. If I take a towel and I soak it in a bathtub and then I take it out and I wring it out on Shabbos, there's no doubt that that would be considered a malach on Shabbos. This is relevant when a woman goes to the mikvah on Shabbos and you have the hair is all wet on Shabbos and now you want to come out. To wring out the hair might be a major issue of Shechita. Obviously, to pat it down is not a problem because you're not really squeezing, but to wring out one's hair as you would normally do, that would be a major question of Shechita on Shabbos. So the question here is, what is the actual activity that is being performed when one uses a baby wipe on Shabbos? What happens? Are you really squeezing it out? Even if I'm squeezing it out, do I have any interest in the activity that's being done? I don't really want that this should be squeezed, that the moisture should be separated from the cloth. All I want is just that the kid should be clean. So it happens to be an unintended consequence. Normally we assume when something is an unintended consequence, it's not a problem at all. However, if it's something that happens every time, then it's a problem, even if I don't want that unintended consequence, like we mentioned by the refrigerator. If I know, even though I have no interest in the light going on when I open the fridge, if I know with certainty that that's going to happen every single time, we assume that would pose a problem, even if it's not what you want. So over here, that's the major issue that we have to think about. What exactly takes place when one uses a baby wipe on Shabbos? Now, public disclaimer, I believe that baby wipes are permissible on Shabbos. That's what I've been taught, and I am here to share that side of the argument why we feel that it's permissible. For those who might have a different opinion, ma tov u'manayim, it's great for you, or it's horrible for your kids. But I feel there's a very strong argument to be made why this should be permissible. So let's read through it together. I think this is a very fascinating issue. I know most people in the room normally don't read Tshuva Svarim. You don't read Responsa. But if you ever have the opportunity to do so, you'll notice, let's say there's 100 different Responsa in one book. Normally, each Responsa is about a different issue. But here, what's interesting is, when Rav Asher Weiss wrote his first volume of the Tshuvas Minchas Asher, when he wrote his first volume of his Responsa, he has three chapters in a row about baby wipes. Because it's not such a simple issue, and everybody was arguing with him. He printed his second volume of Responsa subsequently, and once again, he got nasty letters about what he wrote in the first one about the baby wipes, so he writes a Response again about the baby wipes. So this is a very interesting issue, how you find four tshuvas in one person's writing about the very same issue. So I gave a brief synopsis here. This is obviously not everything that he writes, but this is the major points that I think are relevant to what we're talking about, and to the argument as to why it should be permissible on Shabbos. Yes?
Would this also be applicable?
Yes, somebody asked that last night. It's a great question, and you'll see that you have to really know exactly what the nature of the pad is that you're using. Let's say somebody asked last night about a Swiffer. So I don't know if many people here have the Swiffers or not, but the Swiffer, that's the moist Swiffer cleaner, I don't know what you call it. I don't know that those are very similar to baby wipes. Those, when you take them out of the package, they're dripping wet. So again, you have to know exactly the nature of each item. You have to know what kind of wipe you're using. But let's just go through the basic discussion here, and then we'll see how it applies maybe to some of the other items that might be used as well.
Aside from the issue of that you don't have an unintended consequence, mm-hmm. There's also an issue that when you squeeze something, you normally squeeze it because you want the stuff that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you don't want the stuff that comes out, you just want to use the towel.
Really? You don't want the stuff that comes out? So why is it that you don't use a dry wipe? You should just use a paper towel. We don't do that, right? So that's, you're splitting hairs. You got to figure out, do you really not want it? You do really want it. And you do want the kid to have, so we're going to get to that. You'll see, it will be part of the discussion. But these are all issues that need to be thought about. What I think is what's remarkable about this, and this is why I really want everyone to read it together and to learn through it together, is because I was taught that one of the greatest contributions of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was probably one of the greatest halachic authorities in the last 25 years, one of his great contributions was that he taught us that when one approaches a shaila that is relevant to the modern day world, one has to know what they're talking about before you paskin the shaila. That was not always a given. Very often, 50 to 100 years ago, tshuvas were being written when the rabbi had absolutely no idea what the technology was all about. People were writing in theory. They assumed that a microphone is this. They assumed this is the way the technology works. And based on their assumption, this is the conclusion they came to. But it wasn't always so close to the reality. And this is something that Shlomo Zalman Auerbach really changed. That he taught us, anytime you have a medical question, one needs to sit down with a doctor and really understand what is the technology necessary to deal with this question. And anytime you have an issue with regard to Malacha on Shabbos and Shabbos clocks and everything else, one has to really have a good understanding of what exactly takes place when this activity is being done. How does it work? What is the mechanism? If you don't understand that, you cannot really paskin a shaila. Here, it's remarkable because before writing his answer, he went to factories and sat down with the people that manufacture baby wipes to discuss exactly what is the nature of a baby wipe. How are they made? What takes place when this is put into the package? How do you make it, and why is it made in the way that it's made? And only then do we come to a conclusion about whether or not we should allow this on Shabbos. It's remarkable, it's important that we know that this is the way shilas are dealt with today. And if a person ever has a question that is a very contemporary question, it could be in any area of halacha. You know, how many times do we have shilas and ilchus nida? And it's so intricate to know all of the issues that are revolving around the technologies that can be used today, and IVFs and everything, IUIs and everything that we use today that never existed 50 years ago. We have to make sure that we are well aware of all of the technologies and all of the resources that we have before engaging in a psak on a given question that might be raised. So this is something that I think is very important, and it's indicative to the way we approach halacha today, which is, I guess a great blessing of our generation, that we have that opportunity to sit together with professionals, with medical professionals, with technology professionals and to really understand what it is that we're dealing with. So let's begin as follows. The first paragraph from line 1 to line 7 is just framing the question, and that is, L'she'elos harabim, many people have asked, Mutar lehishtamesh b'shabbos, is one allowed to use migvonim lachim? Am I allowed to use baby wipes that are moist on Shabbos? V'ikar ha'she'ela, and the main question is, Em yesh bazeh isur schita, is there a prohibition of squeezing on Shabbos when I use the baby wipe? V'im achin yesh bazeh chashash schita, if in fact there is an issue of squeezing out the baby wipe when I use it on Shabbos, Yesh la'ayin, and one has to think about him, have a davar hamischavin. Do I really want the moisture to be squeezed out of the baby wipe, like you mentioned before? Is that something that's really of interest to me? Not really. I don't really want the moisture to come out. And if you're going to tell me that it's an unintended consequence, well, maybe it happens every time. So even if I didn't intend for this to happen, but since it happens every time I use the wipe, that should be prohibited regardless. Skip to line 8. Here he writes, Hinei b'shmira Shabbos kilchasa. In the Sefer, which is the most authoritative Sefer on Hilchos Shabbos for the last 50 years, was the Sefer Shmira Shabbos kilchasa. If I'm not mistaken, I think the story behind the Shmira Shabbos kilchasa goes as follows. I've heard this before from many people. I think this is the way it goes. Reb Neuwirth is the one who offered the Shmira Shabbos kilchasa. He was a great Talmud Chacham. He lived in Beit Vegan. And he was a survivor of the Holocaust. He was a German Jew who ended up moving to Eretz Yisrael. And he... During the years of the Holocaust, Reb Neuwirth was hid in a specific place, I think for 2.5 or 3 years, somebody told me, for a number of years. And Reb Neuwirth was in this place, and the only thing they had there was a Gemara Masechet Shabbos. There was only one volume there. And that's what he did for 2.5 years. He had nothing else to do. There was no one to talk to. There was no one to be with. There was one Gemara in the place where he was hiding, and that Gemara was Masechet Shabbos. And apparently he promised the Ribono Shel Olam that if he comes out of this experience alive, and if he survives the terrible horrors of the Holocaust, he will make a contribution in the areas of Hilchos Shabbos, because that's all he had in the times that he was hiding there. And that's really what he did. He made a tremendous revolution with regard to the laws of Shabbos. Every home really should have a set of Shmira Shabbos Kilchasa. It is the most authoritative sefer on Hilchos Shabbos that's been accepted by everyone. And it was really written by Reb Neuwirth, but he did it on the council of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Every psak in there was looked at by Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And it really is the Hilchos Shabbos Sefer of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that was authored by Reb Neuwirth. So he made a tremendous contribution. So there he writes, in the Shmira Shabbos Kilchasa with regard to the baby wipes, line number 9, he says in the name of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, L'hakel bazeh, that one has a right to be lenient when it comes to using baby wipes on Shabbos. Why is that the case? We won't have to read the next part inside. The reason for that is as follows. He quotes a parallel halacha, which he says is the same to our case. He says it's similar. What is that parallel case? He says, well, we know that one is not allowed to violate the laws of Schita. One is not allowed to squeeze something. That goes for Shabbos and Yom Tov alike. Yom Tov also that applies. One's not allowed to squeeze something out. So here he writes the following. What happens on Erev Yom Kippur? Person takes a shower, and I come out of the shower, and I dry myself off. I think to myself, you know, tomorrow I would really appreciate if I was able to freshen up a little bit. Yom Kippur morning, we can't take a shower, but it would be nice to have a little bit of a freshener. So the person says to themselves, I'm not going to, you know, sometimes when you come out of the shower, you let yourself dry off a little before you put the towel on. But sometimes you come out and the towel gets all wet, very, very wet. So the person comes out of the shower and the towel gets soaking wet from all of the moisture that's on your body. And you leave it, you don't let it dry, you just leave it right there. The next morning you wake up Yom Kippur morning, you say, I have a great idea. I'll wipe my face with this moist towel. It sounds like a good idea. So there's nothing wrong with that, the Shulchan Aruch says. However, the Shulchan Aruch writes, what about the issue of schita? Shouldn't I be concerned that maybe you're going to squeeze out the moisture that's in the towel? After all, that really is what's happening. When you take the towel, we're not talking about a towel that's soaking wet and still dripping. We're talking about a towel that you used for the shower the night before. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, you're allowed to use that the next day to wipe off your face if you want to freshen up a little bit on Yom Kippur morning, even though we know scientifically that some of the moisture from the towel is obviously going to be squeezed out. That is something that is permissible on Shabbos. That's what the Shulchan Aruch writes. There's no question about it. That's for sure okay. And therefore, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach argued that this should be the same. Why should it be the same? Because here too, you have something which is like a towel, which is wet, and you just want to squeeze it out a little bit to wipe off the child and make the child clean. Shouldn't be a problem. That should be parallel to the case by Yom Kippur. Well, not exactly the same, right? Anyone thinks that's the same? No, why not?
It's different. The child is not clean. You are just sort of dusting.
Oh, I was saying in the other direction, I would have said it's not the same. I would have said in the other direction, by the towel, nothing's really getting squeezed out of the towel when I put it over my face. Over here, when I use a baby wipe and the child is very dirty, I guess this is what you meant to say, if the child is very dirty and I'm using a baby wipe, I really am squeezing it out because I have to apply pressure when I use it to clean off the child. So it's not exactly the same, not exactly parallel, but Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in the Shmir Shabbos Golchasa, he was comfortable relying on that parallelism to say that baby wipes should be permissible on Shabbos. Okay, there were those who came later on and said, absolutely not, how can we accept that? What do you mean? Over there, you're talking about a person who takes a towel, wipes it on their face. That's not the same at all to a person who takes a wipe and is going to squeeze it and use pressure on the child. That should not be something that we should accept at all. And this was the major question, whether or not we should accept the ruling of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Skip down to line 27. There were those who claimed that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach himself retracted from what he originally said. There were those who said that, yes, in the original edition of the Shmir Shabbos Kelchaser, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that it's mutter. However, he changed his mind later on, and he felt that this is not a parallel at all, and therefore we cannot allow the baby wipes to be used on Shabbos. So we have to deal with all this. Let's start with line 27. Uma eset. So he writes, what can I do? La'anias daiti, in my opinion, halacha kemishna rishona, I believe that what Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote in the first place, in the first edition of Shmir Shabbos Kelchaser, is the correct psak, and that is that baby wipes are permissible on Shabbos, as learned from the parallel case in Shulchan Aruch with regard to using the towel on Yom Kippur morning. Dibi bedikos rabo she'arachti, he writes, in the many experiments that I did, I guess he changed a lot of diapers, nochachti ladas, I came to the conclusion, dibi shimush mikubal b'migvonim hamutsuyim kiyom bashuk, that a normal person who uses a wipe in the normal way, we're not talking about a person who's scrubbing the baby, we're talking about a case, baby has a normal dirty diaper. So yes, every so often it does happen. I'm sure you've all had the great fortune of putting your child into bed, and literally 5 minutes after they go to sleep, they have a very dirty diaper. You don't smell it till the next morning. By the time you get to change their diaper, it's very difficult to clean them. Anyone ever had that? Right? I assume. Once in a while it happens. I assume it's not only in our house. So yes, that's an unusual case. And yes, it's true. When that happens and you have to apply an unusual amount of pressure, maybe that's a different story. But in the normal case of events, when you're just cleaning off the child, we assume it's not really something that is schita at all. Line 29. You cannot really see the moisture that's being let out from the wipe. If a normal person is cleaning a normal diaper, you don't see anything that's residual after you finish wiping the child. Even though it requires me to use a little bit of pressure, and obviously something is going to be extracted from the wipe, we don't really assume that that is called srita at all. Why is that the case? How come I actually don't see anything moist after I finish wiping the child? The reason is very simple. He says he met with the people who manufacture baby wipes, and they told him the following. It makes a lot of sense. Mishum shemagvonim elu miyutzarim, because the way these are manufactured is beofen shehanozel tofeach aleihem ve'eno nivla behem. The way these are manufactured is that the moisture is on top of the wipe; it is not absorbed into the wipe. Ki kol toelas magvonim elu hi. The whole reason why we use these baby wipes instead of paper towels is Shekamas mu'ata shall knows them mufreshes mehem al gabi haguf. All you want is that a very minimal amount of fluid, of moisture, should go onto the baby. Umis adam me'alei akach, and it disintegrates, it evaporates by itself. She'ein sorech beniguv nosaf la'achar hashimash bahem. Imagine if every time you change the baby's diaper, you would have to come with a towel and then wipe the baby because now they're all wet. Nobody does that. Why do we not do that? If you really believe that every time you use a baby wipe, there's so much moisture that's coming out from the wipe that's being used, how come you don't go and wipe the baby off after you finish cleaning them? Answer is, because there's nothing there. And we know, if you don't dry off a baby after giving them a bath, and you just put the diaper on, they'll get a diaper rash. That doesn't happen every time you change a baby's diaper. Why? Because there is no moisture, there's nothing there. There's a drop that disintegrates, it evaporates, but it's nothing recognizable, it's nothing noticeable. And he writes, line 36, Dehalo yadua. Everybody knows, anybody I guess who's ever changed a baby's diaper knows, if you put on the diaper while the child is still wet, they're going to get a diaper rash. Alkein, and therefore, miyutzar magvonim ela ba'ofin miyuchad, therefore, when they manufacture these baby wipes, they do it in a way, kach shabli asan muwata, that there's limited absorption in the wipe. All they do is they have a very small amount of liquid, of fluid that is on top of the wipe. If it would be absorbent, then every time you would take a wipe out of the package, your child would get all wet. But that's not the case, and we know it's not the case. And therefore he says that this is not something they have to be concerned about, and he says another reason why they don't make them absorbent is because the manufacturers told them, if you'll see on line 40 and 41, the manufacturers told him that if they would be absorbent, then they would fall apart, they would disintegrate when you start wiping with them. So they make them specifically in a way that they don't absorb the moisture. This way the towel stays the way it is, and it's just a very limited amount of moisture on top that will keep the towel intact and it will not fall apart as you use them. Line 43. Ubedikos she'arachti nochachti ladas. And in my experience trying to experiment this issue, I've come to the conclusion, da'af im mekalfin magvon letoch kaf hayad v'sochtem oso, even though it's true that if I take a bunch of wipes and I put them into my hand and I squeeze them into a ball, obviously moisture is going to come out, obviously liquid is going to drip down, there's no question about it. However, he says, when you're just using one at a time and you don't crumple them up into a ball, that certainly does not happen. And therefore, he writes, he doesn't see a problem, and even if once in a while some moisture is going to be squeezed out because accidentally it did get absorbed into the towel, that is not something that is a psik resha, that does not happen every time. It does not happen every time that you use a baby wipe that you're squeezing it out, and therefore he makes the argument that he sees nothing wrong with that at all. Line 55. Everybody okay so far? That's what he argues. Line 55, Iraisi. And I saw, Ba'archa Shabbos, I saw in the Sefer Archa Shabbos, who is the big proponent of not using the baby wipes on Shabbos, that's the one who's arguing back and forth with him, Shenizbara Ayide Bedika Mada'it Shalmumchim. He argues that the reason why he feels it's not permissible to use them is because he sat down with a bunch of scientists, and they told him that scientifically, there is moisture that is being squeezed out of this baby wipe. So what do we do with that? So Rabbi Asher Weiss argues, I think, what is a very cogent argument. He says, yes, it might be true that scientifically, on a very minuscule level that most of us who are not scientists cannot even appreciate, yes, it might be true that that's what's happening. But when it comes to defining the malachas of Shabbos, we don't go to the scientists to define our malachas for us. It doesn't mean we don't believe in science. It just means, lo nitna Torah lamalachei asheris. The Torah was given to human beings, not to people who are experts. It was given to normal people. And it was given in a way where normal people have to figure out how to keep the laws of the Torah. So we are not expected to go and do chemical testings to figure out whether or not something's being squeezed out or not. That's ridiculous. That's not an expectation that we have. My father says over the story very often, there's a halacha that when a man wears tefillin, the tefillin have to be absolutely square. They cannot be in any way not squared off. So if you have a nick in one side of the square of the tefillin, that would make the tefillin invalid. So my father says over that he knows a dentist who spends his whole day, his whole life, doing dental implants and fixing people's teeth and making them exactly straight, exactly the way they're supposed to be. And this guy told him every time he walks into shul in the morning, he looks at people's tefillin, he sees they're absolutely not square at all. Why? Because his eyes are trained to see things that most normal eyes can't see. So he says, do I have an obligation to start going over to people and saying, by the way, I want you to know, you think it's square, but it's not. And you think yours is square and it's not, you better go get it fixed. Or do we say, no, the Torah doesn't expect us to go with a measuring stick and figure out exactly with the perfect eyes, with this dentist's eyes, to figure out exactly whether or not the tefillin is square? No, if we assume that it looks square, and to most normal people this would be considered to be square, therefore we assume that's what we can rely on, and we don't have an obligation to go by what the scientific evidence might show. Doesn't mean that we disregard science. It just means we are expected to live the laws of the Torah in the normal, natural way. And this is an application that applies to many other areas of halacha as well. Let's say Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about, how do we ever have the right to eat vinegar? How does vinegar become vinegar? What? Fermentation. How does fermentation happen? Bugs. Bugs go into the wine. Microorganisms that are not noticeable to the naked eye. And they make the wine into vinegar. Correct? Ask Rav Moshe. Every time that you consume vinegar, it means you're eating bugs. Obviously. It has to be. We're not allowed to eat bugs. How could it be? Says Rav Moshe, nobody's able to see those bugs, so we don't have to worry about them. if it's something that is not noticeable to the naked eye. Yes, it might be true. If you put it under a microscope, you see something there. But we are not expected to live life under a microscope. And therefore, we assume that since that is just scientific, but it's not something that most normal people are able to have a relationship with, therefore we assume we don't have to worry about that. That's the same argument that he makes over here. Yes, it might be true. A scientist who has a very good and clear understanding and certain utensils they can use to figure out whether or not some moisture is coming out of the baby wipe or not every time you use it, yes, it might be true that that's what they argue, that some moisture is coming out. But to the naked eye, to the normal person who's using this, who doesn't have that expertise, we assume, since they do not see that happening, we assume that should not be a problem at all. Yes, a question.
That people would take to the nth degree. So it says that the shilas on the Shamayim are different than what the shilas are on earth. So really, it speaks to your point.
That's correct. Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, so that's the first argument that he makes. He got, obviously, a big backlash for his opinion that was published. And then in the second volume, he goes once again to prove his point and to say why he believes that it's true. So you look at the bottom of page number one, of side number one, line 74, where he writes back to Rabbi Rubin, who sent him a nasty letter saying that he thought everything he wrote about the baby wipes was incorrect and cannot be accepted. So he gets into a whole discussion with him. Look at the next side of the page, and you look at line number 8. And this is such a critical point. It's so important because it's relevant to other areas of halacha as well. Line number 8. Rabbi Rubin sends a letter where he says, what do you mean? You're basing your argument on the fact that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman wrote in the Shmiras Shabbos Kilchasa first edition that baby wipes are permissible. I know that people had private conversations with him where he said that he retracted. So he says, how can you rely on what's written if, after all, we know people who spoke to him and he said he retracted? So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? This is a major issue because it comes up every so often. You have a lot of people who have private conversations with great people and they tell you what they said. Do we believe it? No, we shouldn't. But that's a question. What if they're reliable people? So what does the reliable person's word mean when there's a printed word that's against them? So that's a very important question. And it's an important question because it's relevant to other areas of halacha as well. Look at line number 13. Ach tamea ani. He says, it's implausible, it's impossible for me to imagine. Im achin chazerba hagon Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach mimashi hitir. If you really believe that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach retracted from what he originally said, baby wipes are permissible, hayazela reishis chovaso lachzer bar b'shar bas rabin. How many times I can tell you my father's been attacked in the newspapers? Happens all the time. Unfortunately, but it happens all the time. So, people attack my father in the newspaper for something that never happened, for something that he never said, and then they send us, as children, they send us a private email, oh, please be mochel us. Oh, we didn't realize that this was a circumstance. We didn't realize that was going to happen. I always write back to all those people. If that's what you feel, go publish your email that you sent to me in the same front page of the newspaper that you wrote your original attack. It doesn't work that way. If you write something publicly, it's your responsibility, if you don't believe in what you said, to go back to the same source and retract that which you wrote. But people never do that. People are never willing to do that. But because the people who attack in the newspapers are lowlives. That's why they don't do it. Right? They're lowlives. Those are the only people who write things like that. When we're talking about responsible people who are responsible for what every Jewish home is going to do when it comes to using baby wipes on Shabbos or not, if you, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, wrote a psak that everyone's relying on, that you're allowed to use the baby wipes on Shabbos, and now you're retracting from your opinion, you have an obligation to write a public statement that all of us will see clearly that you retracted from what you originally felt was your opinion. You can't just tell someone in a private conversation, that's not good enough. We can't believe that. So he writes the following, number 14. Hayazela reishis chavaso. This would be the primary obligation of a leader of the Jewish people, lachzer bo b'shar bas rabim, to retract in a public fashion. Ulo hodia kabel amva eda b'chsav yada uvishmo, and to let everybody know clearly in his own handwriting, she'asur lehishtamish b'magvonim elu. You have to let everyone know, in the same place where you published your first opinion, you have to publish now your second opinion that you retracted. Kedei limnoa michshal arabim, in order that you should be able to stop people from making the mistake based on what they originally saw in your writings. Now this is a major question that has troubled many over the millennia. Let's say one very famous example is the story of the Noda Behuda. Noda Behuda lived in the 1800s. He was Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. He is the Dayan in Prague, a very great Talmud Chacham. He decided that, you know, there are so many measurements that we rely on throughout the year. How much matzah you have to eat, how much mar you have to eat, all the different things, how much you're allowed to eat in Yom Kippur. He said, you know what, I better do my own experiment and figure out whether all the measurements that we assume to be true are really the right ones. So he does a whole experiment, and he comes to the conclusion everything is wrong, and it's really twice the size that we're supposed to be, that we always assumed it was. This is why you ever wonder, how much matzah you need to eat on Pesach? A kezias. How much is a kezias? An olive. You ever wonder, how did an olive become a half a matzah? Anyone ever wonder that? When they pass around the matzah on the night of the Seder that everyone's supposed to eat, how did it become a half a matzah? How is that possible? The answer is because the Nabi Yehuda said all of our measurements are wrong. And he said everything is really twice the size that we originally thought it was and twice the volume, and therefore we have to be machmir when it comes to the matzah on the night of the Seder, which is a mitzvah midaraisa. We have to try to satisfy his opinion, and that's why we have much more. It's an exaggerated shear. So the question is, the Nabi Yehuda writes this in a sefer that he believes everything was wrong until this point. We have to reevaluate all of the measurements and everything is supposed to be twice the size that it originally was. That's what he writes. His future student, his name was Rabbi Lezer Fleklish, he was put out a sefer called the Tshuva Me'ava. He writes, nah, my Rebbe didn't really mean what he said, and the whole thing was just a joke, and he was just making an experiment. It wasn't really to be taken literally. Really? So what does that mean? So where are we left now? The student says that the teacher retracted. The teacher didn't retract publicly. He wrote what he wrote, and it's for public use. So what do we go by? So the Chazon Ish writes, do you think the Nabi Yehuda would have done such a thing? If he wrote publicly that everybody's been wrong for the last 500 years, and now he's retracting from what he thought they were wrong about, would he not have made it his business to write it in a public forum? Or to let everybody know that what he wrote was a mistake? Of course he would have. And from the fact that he didn't, it means that he obviously believes in that which he wrote. And the same applies to Beis Yosef writes in other areas as well. Let's say there's a discussion. Any Sfardim in the room? No? We don't discriminate. Sfardim are welcome also. So there's a big question as to whether one is supposed to recite the bracha Hanosein Layoef Koach every morning. Big question, because it doesn't really show up in the Gemara. Maybe we shouldn't recite a bracha that doesn't come up in the Gemara. So the Beis Yosef writes something that you shouldn't say it. Then there were those who said, no, the Beis Yosef changed his mind later on, you should say it. Back and forth, back and forth. So what do you mean? You look in the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef says, Sfardim should not say the bracha. So someone comes along and tells you the Beis Yosef changed his mind? What do you mean? If he changed his mind, he would have told us he changed his mind, but he didn't. He didn't write that anywhere that he changed his mind. He had many opportunities to write that publicly, but he never wrote that. And therefore, there are many who argue that whatever the Beis Yosef himself wrote is what stands. That's what's binding. We don't go and look for other accounts of what he may have said in a private conversation. That's irrelevant to the conversation here. And so too over here, line number 30. V'kach gam b'nidin didan. Me'achar she'agon Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach pirsem daito lahatir b'shmir Shabbos kilchasa. Since Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote explicitly in the Sefer Shmir Shabbos kilchasa that this is permissible, u'ledivrei kesarosha baruchas Shabbos avkasav tshuva lahatir, and he never retracted publicly. So you're saying, yes, people had private conversations with him and maybe he changed his mind, but never publicly did he retract. I don't believe anyone who tells me that his opinion is anything less or anything different than that which is stated publicly in the book that he wrote. Final paragraph, line 35. And not only do I not believe that because I always believe the printed word over the hearsay, Me'idach, he says, Shamati pa'amim rabos. I heard many times with my own ears. Me'hagon ha'gadol Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert, from the author of the Shmir Shabbos Gilchasa. Gadol Talmidav, who was one of the greatest disciples of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Sha'ad Yomo ha'acharon amad al daito lahakil. Until Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's last day, he believed that one can still be makel and rely on the fact that baby wipes are mutter on Shabbos. So I don't know if it means on his deathbed he was still asking about the baby wipes, but he says that this was a conversation they obviously had not just 50 years ago, but it was something that continued on for many, many years. And he said, until the very end of his life, he heard with his own ears that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach still remained with his original opinion. Echen shamati, and that's what I heard. Mibnei mishpachto shel Hagaon Rav Shlomo Zalman. That's what the family members told me also. V'kach haisagam daito shel Baal HaIgros Moshe, and that is what Rav Moshe writes as well. Final conclusion. Umishum kalanal, and because of all that we have mentioned, ani al mishmarti amoda, I believe that the feeling is the mutter leishtamish shimush ragil umekubal mekvonim elu. One is certainly allowed to use baby wipes on Shabbos based on this. Number one, it's not even clear that these are absorbent, so it might not even be a discussion of schita, even to begin with. let's say, by toothbrushes. This is a major question that many discuss on Shabbos. Is one allowed to use a toothbrush on Shabbos? Right? So some people brush their teeth on Shabbos, some people don't. What's the question about? There are a number of questions, but one of the issues that revolves around brushing teeth on Shabbos is it schita when one puts water on the toothbrush and now you're going to brush it, so now the water is getting squeezed out? What's the answer to that question? It's not. Why? Because the bristles are non-absorbent bristles. Otherwise, your toothbrush would be moldy after a week. Right? Doesn't happen. The bristles are non-absorbent. The water gets stuck in between the bristles, but the bristles themselves are non-absorbent, and that's where Rav Soloveitchik said, with regard to that issue, there are a number of issues that come up when you talk about brushing teeth, but with regard to the issue, let's say a person just wants to take a toothbrush with water and brush your teeth on Shabbos with nothing else, there should be no shaila, because it's not schita, you're not squeezing anything, there's no water stuck inside. And the same over here, number one, this is made of non-absorbent material. So even when you use it and you see that water is coming out, it's not even clear in the first place that it's being squeezed out. The water was on top, and the water was never absorbed into the material itself. That's number one. Number two, even if it may be absorbent material, let's say one in every 500 is going to be absorbent, even so, does a naked eye notice that there's moisture that is stuck on the child after the baby wipe is used? No. So yes, it's true. The scientists have proven that that is the case, that that is what's going to happen. But does that really define how we look at the malacha? No. The same way that the dentist is not going to be able to define whether tefillin are square, even though he has eyes that can see things that most of us cannot see, that's the same over here. We don't have an obligation to go running after scientists to determine for us whether or not we assume this would be a malacha of schita or not. So these are some of the issues with regard to that, but really the most important issue is, even if it is absorbent, we still should say it's a davar she'eino mischavein. It's something that was an unintended consequence. I have no interest in it being squeezed out. And don't tell me that every time you squeeze this, every time you use it, that's what's going to happen. It's not true. Yes, it's true if you take a ball of them and you crush them up into a ball in your hands. Yes, moisture is going to squeeze out, but that's not the normal case. In the normal usage of baby wipes, we assume nothing is really taking place, and that would not be considered a psik resha because it does not happen every time. And as a result of that, there is a very strong argument to be made that baby wipes should be permissible on Shabbos. Questions? Yes?